I like how we're coming in hot.
Coming in hot is right.
That's right, folks. It's time for another episode of the New Yorker Political Scene. I'm your host, Russ Finkelstein. I want to say thanks again to Will Sloan, who joined me on last week's episode, where we reviewed the New Yorker Political Scene's review of the 1993 documentary, The War Room. If you didn't listen to it, do yourself a favor. We had a good time. I think we did a good job. So thanks again, Will, and everyone should go check out the Michael and Us podcast as well as the Important Cinema Club podcast, both of which Will co-hosts. I wanted to start this week by talking about an article that the New Yorker magazine has put out. The headline of that article is The Haditha Massacre, Photos That the Military Didn't Want You to See. And it includes some horrific images from a 2005 massacre committed by U.S. Marines in Iraq. It's hard for me to recommend anyone look at these pictures because they're absolutely brutal. They depict dead children and bloody scenes in the homes of a family. These images have been getting a lot of pickup on social media, I think in part because they're very reminiscent of what we're witnessing now in Gaza. The writer Madeline Barron explains in this New Yorker article that the magazine obtained these photos through a Freedom of Information Act request because they belong to the U.S. military, but the magazine thinks that they're important and worth Americans seeing to understand the horrors of the war in Iraq. Of course, if you were to go back in time and read from the New Yorker during the war in Iraq, you might read things like the article titled Making a Case that New Yorker editor David Remnick wrote in 2003, where he essentially makes the case for why the United States should invade Iraq. Or you might want to go back and listen to a 2023 episode of the New Yorker Political Scene with none other than Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, and Evan Osnos, where them and a couple of other guests who are all New Yorker writers discuss where they were when the United States first invaded Iraq, and all of them, to a person, say that they thought at the time that the war was justified. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, it seems like the New Yorker is reconsidering that position. I'm reading from Madeline Barron's article that accompanies these horrific pictures. On the morning of November 19th, 2005, a squad of Marines was traveling in four Humvees down a road in the town of Haditha, Iraq, when their convoy hit an IED. The blast killed one Marine, Lance Corporal Miguel Terraza, and injured two others. What followed would spark one of the largest war crime investigations in the history of the United States. During the next several hours, Marines killed 24 Iraqi men, women, and children. They entered three nearby homes and killed nearly everyone inside. The youngest victim was a three-year-old girl. The oldest was a 76-year-old man. The Marines would later claim that they were fighting insurgents that day, but the dead were all civilians. The killings came to be known as the Haditha Massacre. Four Marines were charged with murder, but those charges were later dropped. General James Mattis, who went on to become Secretary of Defense, wrote a glowing letter to one of the Marines, dismissing his charges and declaring him innocent. By 2012, when the final case ended in a plea deal with no prison sentence, the Iraq War was over, and stories about the legacy of the U.S. occupation rarely got much attention. The news barely registered. The impact of an alleged war crime is often directly related to the horror of the images that end up in the hands of the public. The abuse of detainees at Abu Ghraib prison became an international scandal when graphic photos were published. The Haditha killing had no similar moment. A few of the images that the Marines had made ended up in the public domain, but most had never been released. So that is the kind of shit that comes to mind when Kamala Harris says at the Democratic National Convention that if she's elected, she'll make sure that the United States has the most lethal fighting force on Earth. I do think it's worth reflecting on the fact that almost 20 years after this happened, the New Yorker now is having this reckoning with the way we think about the war in Iraq. And you have to wonder what the benefit of hindsight will do to the way we remember this current war in Gaza. Now, before we get to the latest episode of the New Yorker's Political Scene, there's something else in the news I wanted to touch on. The CNN anchor that I used to work with, Caitlin Collins, went on Stephen Colbert, and a clip from that appearance went viral because of the way the audience reacted to Colbert's question.
I know you guys are objective over there, that you just report the news as it is. I know. CNN makes a...
Is that supposed to be a laugh line?
It wasn't supposed to be, but I guess it is.
So a lot of media outlets, and especially right-wing outlets, picked up on this clip because the audience was laughing at the notion that CNN considers itself an objective outlet. Now, Bill Maher, who I absolutely despise, had Caitlin Collins on his show this past week, where he asked her about this moment. Forgive the audio quality, I literally recorded this by holding a microphone up to a speaker, because I couldn't figure out a way to rip it off of the Real Clear Politics video player.
CNN, in my view, should be the place where both sides can watch. How do you think you're doing with it?
How is CNN is the place where both sides can watch. And I think, you know, my show is evidence of that. We have lawmakers on from both parties. We'll have Elizabeth Warren on one night. We'll have Ted Cruz on another night. I think lawmakers from both parties should take questions and you should push both of them. But on CNN being a place of credibility, I mean, look at what just happened in Chicago. We had 300 people from CNN on the ground covering that convention. There were several reporters from just our team alone on the floor, bringing it in real time to people. And I think CNN puts resources behind things and just brings a level of news that you don't get anywhere else. And I think CNN does a great job.
I'm talking about the people on CNN and what I know what the conservative side of America thinks, and I don't blame them. I watched Kamala's speech last night. It ended at 8:09, I guess 11:09 in the East. It wasn't until 11:23, till the one conservative guy, what's his name?
Scott Jennings. This
Lonely Scott, I call him.
David Urban was there too.
Wait a second. I watched from 8:09 to 8:23, they were just gushing about how great a speech it was. And I think she did fine. I didn't think it was as good as they were making it out to be. But if I'm a conservative in America and I'm watching CNN, just for the straight middle of the road, that's what I hear for 15 minutes. It's great, and then Lonely Scott.
Now, the reason why I wanted to play that clip is because it is just such a disingenuous point that Caitlin Collins is making there. First of all, whether it is the Democratic National Convention, the Republican National Convention, a Donald Trump speech, the State of the Union, it doesn't really matter what the event is. The panel that they have coming out of it is almost always the same. You're always going to have David Axelrod there, Van Jones, and even the other people that she mentions, Dana Bash, Jake Tapper, these are people who, if you listen to the interviews they do, you listen to what they say on the air, you can just tell from the way they present the stories that they're covering and from the stories that they select that they have a bias. And that bias is not just liberal. It is a perspective that channels a very narrow political ideology that's somewhere between the center right and the center left. I think a lot of people in the mainstream media get confused about the difference between being neutral and being centrist. And they think that being in the center, politically speaking, is the same as being neutral. And that's not true. Centrism is an ideology just like liberalism, conservatism, leftism, libertarianism, socialism. All of these are different ideologies. Centrism is also its own individual ideology. And second of all, it doesn't really matter what Caitlin Collins says because the overwhelming majority of Americans also think that CNN is biased. There was a Real Clear Politics poll from May of this year that found that of all mainstream media outlets, quote, CNN is the most politically polarizing with a 96-point difference in net trust between Democrats and Republicans. Other networks that are trusted far more for news by Democrats than Republicans include MSNBC, 82-point difference, NBC, 81-point difference, CBS, 78-point difference, and ABC, 76-point difference. Republicans, on the other hand, have a net trust that is 62 points higher than Democrats for Fox News and 51 points higher for Fox Business Channel. The sources most likely to be seen as moderate are television networks CBS, NBC, ABC, and the BBC. What's interesting from this study is that CNN has a more polarizing image, ideologically speaking, than an outlet like MSNBC, which is openly a partisan network. Now, this isn't just because of the guests that the network has on to interview, whether they're interviewing Democrats or Republicans, or whether they're just featuring reported pieces by their journalists, the American public perceives that the institution has a bias. And God save me for agreeing with Bill Maher. Onward now. let's get into this week's episode of the New Yorker Political Scene, where the hosts discuss, what else? The Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America.
Harris's speech was personal and heartfelt at some points, but it was also muscular and sobering at others.
Well, I, for one, found it absolutely terrifying, especially the portion about foreign policy and the military. But we'll get into that a bit later. I'm also curious what Harris meant in that clip about having a story that could only happen in America. Did she mean because both of her parents were immigrants and highly accomplished academics, and then went on to become a lawyer and a prosecutor, an attorney general, a senator, a vice president, and now a presidential candidate? I'm not convinced that that story is a uniquely American one. There are leaders of countries all over the world who have overcome similar structural hurdles, but that's really neither here nor there. Let's hear what else the brain geniuses of the political scene have to say about this convention.
Obviously, this was a speech of Kamala Harris's lifetime. Talk about sky-high expectations. Maybe a month ago, nobody had sky-high expectations for Kamala Harris or indeed for the Democrats this year. But obviously, by this point, you know, we were all expecting not only Beyoncé to... Beyoncé.
I'm sorry, who?
Beyoncé.
How do you, in the year 2024, not know how to pronounce Beyoncé? The only reasonable explanation I can come up with for why Susan Glasser would pronounce Beyoncé that way is because maybe she's trying to one-up all of us, including Beyoncé herself, by using the French pronunciation of her name. But even that would be fucking crazy.
I thought that it did what Kamala Harris needs to do, which is to convince Americans she's not the kind of scary Kamala, Comrade Harris of Donald Trump's recent fever dream imaginings. I don't think she came across as a wild-eyed communist. We might as well point out that she's not, in fact, a crazy Marxist, so that helps. But, you know, it was a fairly... centrist speech, I thought. You know, it was aimed, she said she wanted to be a president for all Americans. There were muscular words about how she was going to sign a tough border security bill, for example. There were words about foreign policy and staying strong and in defense of Ukraine and Israel. So, you know, it wasn't a foaming at the mouth liberal speech.
In fact, it was a foaming at the mouth conservative speech and militaristic speech. If Harris was able to convince anyone who wasn't already going to vote for her with this speech, it was a few hundred thousand moderate Republicans scattered across the country who were happy to see her basically echoing Donald Trump's border policies and a George W. Bush-esque foreign policy posture, where she specifically emphasized that the United States needs to maintain the most lethal fighting force in the world. One thing that made me chuckle the night of Harris's speech was a piece of fake news that was circulated by my former colleague at CNN, Don Lemon, who tweeted that George W. Bush was going to give a speech as a special secret guest that night. Now, that didn't come to fruition, of course, but I think it was able to spread like wildfire because it was a believable idea. The Democratic Party's foreign policy of 2024 feels to me a lot like George W. Bush's platform of 2004. Where Bush was having to justify not just the war in Afghanistan, but also the war in Iraq. Now, apart from Harris's speech, the convention also included a number of Republican speakers. That included former Donald Trump staffer Stephanie Grisham, Republican and Nicaraguan American Anna Navarro, who has said that the reason why she became a Republican was that Ronald Reagan supported the Contras, the right-wing death squad, that her father was a commander of. This was a militia that was so murderous, that had so little regard for human rights, that the United States Congress had to pass a law saying that no dollar could go to supporting them. Of course, Ronald Reagan was able to circumnavigate that law in the Iran-Contra scandal, but anyway, that hasn't prevented Anna Navarro from being a CNN commentator, a host of The View, and a speaker at the Democratic National Convention. So it's not a major stretch of the imagination to think that George W. Bush might have shown up there.
The subtext to We're Not Going Back, which has turned out to be the most powerful piece of rhetorical technology in this race is it's not only a comment on a whole conception of politics, including trickle-down economics and divisive tribal language that we use against one another. It also is, frankly, a generational case. And, you know, when you see the crowd seizing on that idea with such enthusiasm, in a way that she doesn't even have to make explicit, just her very place at the lectern on that stage is an eloquent testimony to the idea of going forward, not back.
First of all, I love that he calls the phrase, "we're not going back," a piece of rhetorical technology. That's why they pay Evan Osnos the big bucks. A lesser man would have just called it a slogan. Second of all, I've said this before. To me, the phrase, "we're not going back," as it's used in the Harris campaign, seems to be a response to Republicans and their effort to repeal abortion rights across the country. I have never gotten the impression that it's a response to trickle-down economics. And I'm not even sure that trickle-down economics is something that Kamala Harris is opposed to. Nor do I really see it as a generational thing. Kamala Harris is, I think, 60 years old. And maybe because Evan Osnos is himself significantly older than me. Sorry, buddy. Maybe that's why he's reading into it as a sort of generational thing. But I think he's really loading up this phrase to mean any number of messages to voters that I'm not sure are really there. Another one of the convention speakers that these three were really creaming their jeans over is the vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz.
It's the fourth quarter. We're down a field goal, but we're on offense and we've got the ball. We're driving down the field.
I think that's actually a really bad analogy. First of all, Harris and Walz are leading in almost all of the polls. And second of all, it's only August. Think about all that's happened just in the past month. And imagine what can still happen in September and October that could change the dynamics of this race. I think a more accurate analogy would be to say, it's the end of the first quarter and we're leading by a touchdown. To you non-American listeners out there, what I mean by that is, the Harris campaign is trying to frame itself as the underdog in this race. And I think they do that in large part because America loves an underdog and loves to get behind an underdog. And they certainly don't want to give their supporters the impression that they have it in the bag and that they don't need to go out and work to turn out people to vote. But if we're being honest, it's still very early in the game and the Democrats are winning.
Susan, you've been here going around this week, not only inside the United Center, but also there's all kinds of events on the outside. There's parties. I think give people a feel for who haven't been here before. What are some of the kind of strange and interesting moments that you encounter when you're at an event like this?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this definitely, it's the first kind of convention back since the pandemic. So it's really been 8 years since the parties have gathered in person. So there's a lot of pent-up, frenetic socializing, networking, and the like happening here.
I actually think that this is kind of an interesting point. There has not been an in-person Democratic National Convention since Hillary Clinton was the nominee in 2016. Because, of course, the summer of 2020 was the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. So they had to have that almost entirely online Democratic National Convention, remember? I'm working on a theory that there's a lot of bizarre historic moments that happened in 2020 that have sort of disappeared into the ether. Because if you watch TV coverage of the Democratic National Convention, they love to play old clips of Democratic National Conventions past. Of course, we've all seen the clip from the 1992 convention when everyone is dancing the Macarena, or Barack Obama's famous speech at the 2004 convention, but you never hear anything about the 2020 Democratic Convention. And I don't really have a political point to make with any of this. I just think it's fucking weird, isn't it?
I had a great little incident, I think, that kind of sums up where we are in this declining world of the old mainstream media. I was roaming around the United Center the other day, and I came across a lounge that said something like Creators Lounge. And I thought, oh, well, what's that? And I tried to go in there. And the woman said, no, you can't come in here. This is only for creators. And I said, well, you know, hey, I'm a creator. I'm creating words. I'm creating podcasts. And she said, no, this is for creators. And I said, so do you mean they're advocates, that they're, you know, part of the official campaign? And she said, no, ma'am, they're creators.
No.
Well, I met one of these creators last night leaving. the United Center, a very nice young woman who, when I looked her up on Instagram, turned out to have 1 million followers. And it seems like creating involves a lot of video and TikToking and not a lot of reporting. But they are definitely the VIPs among the the journalism class these days.
I don't know what to tell you, Susan. You should probably stay out of that lounge, though. Maybe you should ask your son what happens on TikTok and Instagram. Because look, some people are using it to do reporting. Some people are live streaming events, or they're doing political commentary. Some people are doing dances. They're basically doing the same thing we're all doing. They're trying to balance what they're interested in with what will get people's attention.
Did you get a sense, though, Susan, that there was a lot of concern beforehand about what protesters might do, about what they could disrupt inside or outside? And how much do you think they ended up having an impact here?
Yeah, 1968 Redux, it did not turn out to be. I think we can say that, you know, pretty clearly. This was a party that, you know, really wanted to project unity and did a lot more of it than any of us might have predicted in advance. There seems to be a willingness to, even though she hasn't articulated any significant policy difference with President Biden on the issue of Israel and the war in Gaza, you know, there's a sense that she would have a different approach to it. When she said she would continue America's support for Israel, she got a loud applause, but she got an even louder applause. I mean, really, one of the loudest roars of the entire evening when she said,
"And the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination."
That was her biggest foreign policy applause line. I thought it was very notable.
Yeah, so what can I say? This is really fucking depressing stuff, you know? As someone who cares about the Palestinian cause, it saddens me to say I think that the Democratic Party, and the Harris campaign in particular, has been really effective at diminishing whatever political power the movement for justice in Palestine has had up until now. Remember that I was just saying that I think that there are a lot of historic moments in 2020 that have been effectively memory-holed. I think that there's a parallel to be drawn between what happened to the Black Lives Matter movement going into the fall of 2020 and what feels like might be happening now with activism around Palestine. And God, I hope I'm wrong. Please, prove me wrong. But if you remember, in 2020, the height of the Black Lives Matter protests were that summer, which was before the presidential campaign really heated up in the fall. And once the Democratic Party held their convention and became more focused on beating Donald Trump, a lot of the energy that had gone into the Black Lives Matter movement sort of dissipated. And likewise, I'm getting the sense, and I've heard Palestinian rights activists say, that before Joe Biden dropped out of the race and Kamala Harris emerged as the nominee, it was a lot easier to get people to go to protests. Now, we did see uncommitted delegates demand that the Harris campaign allow a Palestinian-American to speak from the convention stage, but that demand was rejected. And by most of the accounts I've read, including from sources who I trust, like Dave Weigel, for example, protest organizers in Chicago were hoping to see somewhere around 50,000 protesters at some of the demonstrations, and far fewer people than that showed up. And the organizers of a lot of these demonstrations have expressed, first of all, that it's much more attractive for people to protest Joe Biden because he is currently the president. So when he was the nominee, there was a much clearer connection between protesting his candidacy over what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank. But as Susan Glasser is saying here, because Kamala Harris is taking a slightly different tone, and because there's so much energy and excitement about the fact that the Democratic Party is not in a death spiral being sucked into the abyss by Joe Biden, it's much harder to get people to protest against Harris. And I think the fact that the DNC was able to deny not just a Palestinian-American speaker, there was no Arab speaker during the entirety of this convention. There were Muslim-American speakers. Keith Ellison is a Muslim-American, but my understanding is there wasn't a single Arab-American that spoke. And the fact that the DNC was able to do that while there's an ongoing genocide being perpetuated by one of the US's top allies is really pretty stunning. And I think says something about the strength of the pro-Israel movement in our politics. If you've been following the primaries this season, you know that AIPAC spent a record amount of money taking out Jamal Bowman in New York and Cori Bush in St. Louis. And now at the DNC, we've successfully seen Zionism defeat the Palestinian cause, at least on the political stage. I don't know what else to say about that. It's just really fucking depressing.
It's interesting to me that we're so fully immersed in this moment, as it should be, right? A moment of political peril. Jane is the only one who's even brought up the Obamas so far. And, you know, if we'd had this conversation on Tuesday night, you know, we all would have been, you know, dazzled at, and overwhelmed by, you know, a hell of a performance by both Barack Obama and in some ways even more by Michelle Obama.
I was going to say, you could say it was, you know, performance by Obama and her husband. I mean, that really is what the feeling is this week.
Because no one has a monopoly on what it means to be an American. No one. Kamala has shown her allegiance to this nation, not by spewing anger and bitterness, but by living a life of service and always pushing the doors of opportunity open to others. She understands that most of us will never be afforded the grace of failing forward. We will never benefit from the affirmative action of generational wealth.
Mrs. Obama, I know that this is an inopportune time to point this out, but you and your husband are worth $70 million. Are your daughters not going to inherit any of that money? They're not going to see any of the benefits of inherited wealth? And by the way, what is it that you did for that $70 million? Besides marry a guy who'd go on to become the president and then cash in on his name with a media company. Man, sometimes the hypocrisy of these people is just too much to bear. Anyway, sorry to end it on a sour note, guys. Sometimes it just has to be that way. But thanks again for being with me. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends about it. It's really encouraging to see the listenership steadily grow. So let's keep that going as we can. And I promise I'll do my best to try to enjoy the spectacle that is our politics going forward. That's the Russ Finkelstein guarantee. I love you all so much.
Beyonce, Beyonce. Beyonce, Beyonce. Beyonce, Beyonce.